I hear by the library chimes that it's time for us to start, so let's get started. Welcome. Glad that you could make it so early. Does it seem early this morning? Anyway, we're here on the fifth installation, our series, A Candle Against the Darkness. You may remember that we looked in the first place at the history of the denomination, the background of it that made us aware of the problems of slavery and racism very early on. We looked at the development of RP doctrine, biblical doctrine, against slavery and against racism. We looked at the RP role in participating in the Underground Railroad. And today we're going to talk about basically the decade of the 1850s, the storm which is collecting to break forth, in the words of one of our young Covenanter writers at the time, or as I have also called it, could things get any worse? And of course the answer is always yes to that. In November 1850, David S. Ferris, a Reformed Presbyterian senior at Indiana University in Bloomington, wrote an essay on the recently adopted Fugitive Slave Act, which in retrospect seems almost prescient. "Alas, patriotic spirit, thou hast deserted our firesides. Thou hast given place to cowardice and foolishness in the breasts of many of our countrymen." Can you tell this was 19th century romanticism? But although the love of many has waxed cold and the last spark of liberty, thank you, first aid, last spark of liberty has long since been quenched in the bosom of great numbers by the miserable desire of pleasing southern nabobs, yet there are many in the north who are willing to resist this act of abomination with their lives in their hands to the last extreme, yes, to death. And so, even though it's very much high-flown prosody, it reflects a strong spirit in the RP Church at that point, 1850. Now, in the Constitution, Article 1, Section 9, Clause 1, the importation of slaves was prohibited after 1808. That is 20 years after the adoption of the Constitution. The South, however, was looking for ways to get around that prohibition. After all, they needed more laborers, because the invention of the cotton gin by Eli Whitney in 1793 revolutionized the cotton industry, and the need for field workers exploded. In the North, busy with the Industrial Revolution, was getting more laborers by immigration. The slave trade had been declared piracy and severe penalties were threatened, but the law was not enforced. The British banned the slave trade in 1807 and banned slavery in the colonies in 1833 gradually. But in 1834, one of the Caribbean British colonies emancipated all of their slaves immediately. And there was no uprising, no violence, or anything connected with that. It was all decently and in order, which should have allayed some of the fears of the South. Didn't, but it should have. The British East India Company was exempt from that slavery ban until 1843. The importation of slaves continued after 1808. Remember that 8 of the first 12 presidents were from the South, and they had a way of appointing public officials who agreed with them. For example, from 1804 to 1824, the collector of customs at Bristol, Rhode Island, was Charles Collins, who had been a slave captain and was still part owner of 2 slave ships. Was also the brother-in-law of James DeWolfe, a wealthy slave captain, and later a United States senator. Collins, need it be said, was the proverbial fox guarding the hen house. Moreover, the United States would not permit British ships to search ships flying the American flag. That had been one of the causes of the War of 1812. So that American flag flew over slave ships, only some of which were actually registered in this country. Southerners came up with a way to import slaves surreptitiously, bring them into Cuba, where the trade was legal, and take them to Mexico, and then slip them over the border into Texas. From there, they could easily be taken to the slave states, especially Louisiana and Arkansas. Southerners would deposit money in banks in Havana, and the whole procedure worked smoothly. The commission of the British Parliament a commission of the British Parliament reported that over 15,000 slaves had been brought into Cuba in 1835 alone. Compared to the 4 million slaves already in the U.S., that was not a large number, but still it was a number, and their importation was a violation of law. The federal government did not try to stop it. From the 1850s, Southerners no longer admitted that slavery was evil or even undesirable. Pressure from abolitionists had led the South to circle the wagons and tighten the perimeters. The South became a solid unit. In fact, the strongest interest group in the country as a whole. Because most of the national denominations wanted to preserve their peace and unity, their early pronouncements against slavery, which had never been enforced anyway, were erased from their disciplines. In most cases, they did not actually advocate slavery, but the Methodists, Presbyterians, and others banned discussion of the issue and censured members who spoke out in favor of abolition. By 1844 and 45, the Northern churches began to attempt to correct this tendency, and both the Baptists and Methodists divided into Northern and Southern denominations. The Presbyterians and Episcopalians continued as before. As the South grew more militant and unified, the North was also developing a national unity. The North opposed the annexation of Texas, both because slavery was legal there and because slaves were smuggled from Texas into Louisiana and Arkansas. Some in the East threatened secession if Texas were annexed. Moreover, many in the North were aroused in 1836 when the House of Representatives adopted their infamous gag rule to lay upon the table without debate all petitions which dealt with the issue of slavery. John Quincy Adams, ex-president who turned around and ran for Congress, was the principal congressman who labored against that gag rule until it was abolished in 1844. In 1837, the Presbyterian Church divided into old school and new school churches, and this division was in part slavery related. There were other issues, but slavery was part of it. Even though the old school was dominated by defenders of slavery, including Charles Hodge and other faculty of Princeton Seminary, and the new school was influenced by anti-slavery people, both branches continued to include people on both sides, or all sides, really, of the slavery question. By 1847, the Ripley Presbytery in Ohio had been formed out of the Chillicothe Presbytery of the New School branch. It adopted the name Free Presbyterian Church to signal their desire to see the slaves freed. This split had been forced in 1846 when Reverend John Rankin was forced out of his congregation in Ripley, Ohio, and it grew quickly to 72 congregations in 7 presbyteries. Rankin's home, incidentally, was located on a bank just a few yards from the Ohio River. If you step back about 10 feet from where this picture was taken, you're stepping into the river, and was easily accessible to runaway slaves and the helpers who brought them. 1846 was also the year in which the United States invaded Mexico and began what was a fairly short war called what we call the Mexican War. It was really the American-Mexican War. Supposedly, Mexican troops had crossed the border into land which the U.S. claimed and had fired their weapons at a unit of American troops. This was the pretext for the U.S. to invade Mexico. It was kind of their Gulf of Tonkin resolution, if you remember that, a cooked-up incident to justify the U.S. attacking. The Synod of the Reformed Presbyterian Church in 1847 condemned the war as an unjust and bloody war against a neighboring republic with the evident intention of enlarging the slaveholding power of the United States. There was no draft, it was all volunteer, and no covenanters, as far as can be discovered, participated in that war. Where did we go? Yeah, that's the quotation from the RP Synod. The Mexican War proved to complicate a deadlock in Congress over the extension of slavery. A compromise was proposed by Henry Clay in order to avoid a possible civil war and consisted of five acts passed as a bundle. The first was that California was admitted to the Union with a constitution banning slavery. Secondly, Deseret, or which we know as Utah, and New Mexico were allowed to form territorial governments, and the state question of slavery was left to popular sovereignty. The third act was that Texas was paid $10 million to settle her claims against New Mexico and to pay its debts from the Mexican War. The slave trade, but not slavery itself, the slave trade was abolished in the District of Columbia. And finally, a new fugitive slave law greatly strengthened the rights of slaveholders to retrieve fugitives who escaped to the North. And of course, we've talked about how that worked two or three times during our study. The proposed compromise had enemies on both sides. The Southern opposition was led by John C. Calhoun. If he did not get his way, he was ready to blow things up. He was ready to propose an amendment to the Constitution providing for a dual presidency in which each section would always have a veto over the legislation of Congress. The debate was intense. An aging senator from Massachusetts rose and made a now famous speech which carried the day for Henry Clay and the compromise. The abolitionists, of course, opposed the compromise. They had made a hero of Daniel Webster, but now the abolitionists named him Ichabod. The glory is departed. John Greenleaf Whittier, who was a distant cousin of Webster, wrote a poem by that name, Ichabod. So fallen, so lost, the light withdrawn which once he wore, the glory from his gray hairs gone forevermore. Revile him not, the tempter hath a snare for all, and pitying tears, not scorn and wrath, befit his fall. O dumb be passion's stormy rage when he who might have lighted up his age falls back in night. Let not the land once proud of him insult him now, nor brand with deeper shame his dim dishonored brow. Of all we loved and honored, naught save power remains, a fallen angel's pride of thought, still strong in chains. All else is gone. From those great eyes the soul has fled. When faith is lost, when honor dies, the man is dead. Then pay the reverence of old days to his dead fame. Walk backward with averted gaze and hide the shame. The image throughout this poem is of a soul who has fallen from heaven to hell. So fallen, so lost. Even though Webster still lives on defiantly, his soul is dead. Rather than reveling in his shame, let the reader join in hiding it, just as Noah's sons Shem and Japheth walked backward with their faces turned away so that they could cover their drunken, naked father without looking at him. During the debate on the compromise, William H. Seward gave a long and now famous speech in which he called the Fugitive Slave Bill unjust, unconstitutional, and immoral. I quote, "I know that there are laws of various sorts which regulate the conduct of men. There are constitutions and statutes, codes mercantile and codes civil. But when we are legislating for states, especially when we are founding states, all these laws must be brought to the standard of the laws of God and must be tried by that standard and must stand or fall by it. The Constitution regulates our stewardship. The Constitution devotes the national domain to union, to justice, to defense, to welfare, and to liberty. But there is a higher law than the Constitution, which regulates our authority over the domain and devotes it to the same noble purposes." Try to imagine the outrage in the media if a senator today dared to say that. This was Seward's first speech in the Senate. In fact, one of the most significant maiden speeches in the history of the Senate, and immediately placed him in the forefront of anti-slavery public figures. He later served, of course, as Secretary of State for President Lincoln. The attitude of the Covenanters to the Compromise of 1850 is well expressed in that unpublished paper on slavery written by David S. Ferris in November 1850 at Indiana University. And you can see here a contemporary picture of Indiana University in 1850, and you see that it doesn't look much different from Geneva College in 1850. But he wrote, "This law is unspeakably more insulting and violating to the conscience of free men than any act of the British Parliament antecedent to or during the time of the Revolution. Who, claiming the name of an American, will calmly and passively submit to such an arbitrary, villainous law? But although the love of many has waxed cold, and the last spark of liberty has long since been quenched in the bosom of great numbers, by the miserable desire of pleasing southern nabobs, yet there are many in the north who are willing to resist this act of abomination with their lives in their hands to the last extreme, yes, to death." Well, at its next meeting in 1851, the RP Synod made a strong pronouncement against the Fugitive Slave Act. "It is essentially tyrannical, not only securing the enslavement of those who are in fact free, but in forbidding freemen to exercise the sympathies of Christian compassion and commanding them to assist in returning men to cruel bondage. It brings deserved infamy upon our land, dishonors God, and is expressly contrary to the plainest precepts of his law. It is the duty of the ministers of Christ to teach clearly that magistrates in Christian lands should yield to the authority of God's law, and that any law which is in opposition to the precepts of the Bible does not bind the Constitution and ought to be resisted by every means consistent with religion, for we must obey God rather than man." The Synod cited three biblical texts which make clear that the Fugitive Slave Act is contrary to God's law. Thou shalt not deliver unto his master the servant which is escaped from his master unto thee, from Deuteronomy chapter 23. Betray not him that wandereth, Isaiah 6:3. Shelter the outcast, do not reveal the fugitive. And relieve the oppressed, from Isaiah 1:17. Reformed Presbyterians in Scotland and Ireland were watching the struggle against slavery in America with great interest, and their periodicals carried the latest news with editorial comments. In December of 1850, just shortly after this Fugitive Slave Act was passed, the editor of the Irish RP magazine called the new American law infamous. He wrote, "We rejoice, too, that the testimony of our fathers against slavery begins to be more generally appreciated in America." Franklin Pierce, a pro-slavery leader from New Hampshire, was elected president in 1852 on a platform of compromise. He would enforce the law and maintain the Union. Every state but four had given him their electoral votes. We would call that a landslide today. It seemed that, after all, peace and unity were to prevail in the nation. The country was tired of agitation. Prosperity was ahead. People were getting used to the compromise. Opposition to the Fugitive Slave Act seemed to be dying down, until Harriet Beecher Stowe published her famous novel, Uncle Tom's Cabin, in 1852. Her novel was an immediate sensation. In its first year, 300,000 copies were sold in the United States, which was an enormous sale at that point. And the book went on to become the largest selling novel of the whole 19th century. It was expected that there would be no great upheaval in the political realm for 15 or 20 years at least after that compromise. The compromise of 1850 had secured peace in our time, as the later famous or infamous phrase had it. The decade of the 1850s was a period of rapid expansion in the industrial Northeast and the agricultural West. Railroads expanded rapidly. Leaders of the South sought every opportunity for adding new slave territory, including the private seizure of Nicaragua by William Walker and a proposal to purchase Cuba. Invited by the liberals in the U.S. in 1855 to join their struggle against the conservatives, a United States adventurer and illustrious filibusterer named William Walker set himself up as president of Nicaragua after facing a farcical election in 1856. Costa Rica, Honduras, and other Central American countries united to drive Walker out of Nicaragua in 1857. So it didn't last very long there. The compromise explicitly canceled the Missouri Compromise of 1820, which prohibited slavery north of the latitude 36 degrees 30 seconds. It earned for Douglas the hatred of both the South and the North, which was quite an accomplishment at that point. Dubbed a second Benedict Arnold, Douglas was burned in effigy in many places. Chase, Sumner, Stewart, and even moderates such as Edward Everett denounced Douglas for selling the birthright of the free states for a mess of pottage. Nebraska was divided into two, Kansas and Nebraska, and Kansas was admitted as a state in 1854. Well, Stephen Douglas, yes, made himself very unpopular. Okay, here's a fairly typical popular response from a newspaper of that time. Read and ponder the Fugitive Slave Law, which disregards all the ordinary securities of personal liberty, which tramples on the Constitution, etc., etc. It calls on the people of Massachusetts to remember when the next election comes up that your senator voted in favor of this compromise. So this was opposition research at an early stage. The editor of the Covenanter magazine had little hope of real change in the North regarding slavery. While the bill was still pending, he wrote that Northerners in general did not truly hate slavery. He wrote, "We see them taking slaveholders into their homes, their pulpits, their communion tables, their hearts. They yield to and often promote the schemes of slaveholders. They vote for slaveholders for the highest offices, knowing that they will employ their official influences for the support of slavery. They will not listen to a word against the system. They will patronize no paper that opposes it. If ministers, they neither preach nor pray against it. Still more, they despise the colored man at home. If he will go to Liberia, he is a decent man. In Africa, he is Mr. Or even Excellency. But if he stays in America, where he was born, and some generations of his fathers before him, he's a nigger. And yet all this time, smiling upon slaveholders and frowning awfully upon abolitionists and the enslaved," "these people say that they dislike slavery, that it is a great moral and social evil, that the gospel is against it and will eradicate it. Are they sincere?" he said. "No. Instead of hating slavery, they hate the slaves. Instead of hating slavery, they do cordially hate the doctrine that the slave has before God the same rights they have. Instead of hating slavery, they would hold slaves and exercise all the functions of slaveholders themselves if the circumstances were different. The conclusion is this, that the anti-slavery professions of the North, we mean the majority, are a mere sham, a concession to the opinions of the world, perhaps to conscience, but hollow, mere words, backed by no abhorrence of the system, or none that will not readily give way to the attractions of place, power, gain, or fashion. Nor will it avail to say that just now the North is rising against the Nebraska Bill. So it arose against the annexation of Texas, the Mexican War, the Compromise of 1850. But what came of it? Nothing. And should the bill pass, we shall likely see the same huge results. Nothing." Passage of the Kansas-Nebraska Bill opened the way for the battle for Kansas, which we've already discussed. Bleeding Kansas resulted in bleeding as far away as Washington, D.C., where Massachusetts Senator Charles Sumner was beaten to unconsciousness in the U.S. Senate chamber by Representative Preston Brooks of South Carolina, who came across the Capitol building from the House side to the Senate side to give a caning to Senator Sumner. Sumner was beaten so badly that he required 3 years of therapy before he was able to return to his work. A few Covenanters, primarily from southern Illinois, were among the anti-slavery settlers of Kansas. These families settled near Olathe on the Santa Fe Trail and survived bands of border ruffians, or bushwhackers, they were called, from Missouri, who rode through the country seeking and killing anti-slavery men. Both sides left women and children alone. Teenage boys, however, were considered men, and they were fair game. Covenanters hid in the fields, in root cellars, and in haystacks to avoid death. We can share stories of those things actually happening. Billy Cook, age 16, rode with a Jayhawker band because it was too dangerous for him to stay home. Another shock soon horrified the people of the North. In 1857, the Supreme Court handed down its decision in the case of Dred Scott v. Sanford. Scott, born a slave in Virginia, had been taken to St. Louis by his owners, and while there was sold to U.S. Army Major John Emerson. As Emerson was transferred to other posts, he took Scott with him to Illinois, to Wisconsin Territory, Fort Snelling, then back to Missouri, then to Louisiana, then back to Fort Snelling. Scott sued for his freedom on the grounds that residence in free territory gave him the status of a freeman. He won, but he lost on appeal to the Missouri State Supreme Court. He then filed suit in the federal court, lost, and appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. So this had gone through the whole chain of possible legal remedies. That court, the Supreme Court, with Chief Justice Roger B. Taney writing the opinion, delivered the most notorious decision of its history, at least until Roe v. Wade in 1973. Taney, writing for the majority, stated that the words of the Constitution, the people of the United States of America, did not include Negroes. Neither the Declaration of Independence nor the Constitution intended that people who had been imported as slaves nor their descendants should ever be included in the general words, "we the people." Blacks had been regarded for more than a century as beings of an inferior order and altogether unfit to associate with the white race, either in social or political relations, and so far inferior that they had no rights which the white man was bound to respect, and that the Negro might justly and lawfully be reduced to slavery for his benefit. He was bought and sold and treated as an ordinary article of merchandise and traffic whenever a profit could be made from it. A Negro of the African race was regarded by them as an article of property and held and bought and sold as such in every one of the 13 colonies which united in the Declaration of Independence and afterwards formed the Constitution of the United States. As I say, one of the two most notorious decisions of the Supreme Court history, twisting the words of the Constitution. The Covenanter magazine found this too much, even for the strong Covenanter taste. J.M. Wilson, the son of J.R. Wilson, whom we've talked about before, James M. Wilson, pastor in Philadelphia, castigated the Dred Scott decision vigorously. "These are astounding doctrines. The country has heard them with astonishment, and all the friends of liberty with dismay. That the Constitution recognizes slavery in the states where it exists, we do firmly believe. That it contains provisions most iniquitous, as in the articles regarding the return of fugitives and the three-fifths principle, we have ever maintained. But in this decision, we do as firmly believe there has been achieved a deeper depth of iniquity. It seems to us that the cup of the nation's iniquity is nearly full." On the night of October 16, 1859, another event occurred to further galvanize the anti-slavery opinion of the North. John Brown, who had already won national fame by his stand against the border ruffians, or the bushwhackers, in Kansas, and for leading black fugitives to Canada, led a small group of men in seizing the federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry, Virginia. Of course, since 1865, that's been West Virginia. He had hoped that a large number of slaves and white abolitionists would join him. The incident failed to accomplish anything except his own death on the gallows and a heightened tension throughout the nation. The picture you see is a drawing from a magazine at the time showing the federal troops breaking into the final building at Harper's Ferry, where Brown and his few remaining people, including a couple of his sons, were holed up. In the North, men of the highest standing proclaimed him a hero. Emerson likened his gallows to the cross of Christ. Brown's letters, written from prison, show that he was not insane, as many have since claimed. The Reverend A.M. Milligan, pastor of the New Alexandria Reformed Presbyterian Church in Pennsylvania, over in Westmoreland County, wrote a letter to Brown on November 24, 1859, saying that, and I quote, "There are some Orthodox and earnest Christians who regard you as a martyr to civil liberty." He added, "If you have made all the sacrifice for Christ's and his cause's sake, you have the promise of 100-fold more in the present life, and in the world to come, life everlasting. You have been called before judges, and it has been given you what to say and how to speak. And I pray that when you are called to witness a good confession before many witnesses, there may be given you dying words that will scathe and burn in the hearts of this great and mighty nation until their oppression of men and treason against God shall be clean purged out." John Brown replied to Milligan on November 29, 1859, among his last letters. He wrote, "My dear Covenanter friend, notwithstanding I now get daily more than three times the number of kind letters I can possibly answer, I cannot deny myself the satisfaction of saying a few words to a stranger whose feelings and whose judgments so nearly coincide with my own. No letter of a great number I have got to cheer, encourage, and advise me has given more heartwarming satisfaction or better counsel than your own. I hope to profit by it, and I am greatly obliged for this, your visit to my prison. It really seemed to impart new strength to my soul, notwithstanding I was very cheerful before. I trust, dear brother, that God, in infinite grace and mercy, for Christ's sake, will neither leave me nor forsake me till I have shown his power to this generation and his strength to everyone that is to come. I would most gladly commune further as we journey on, but am now so near the close of mine that I must break off, however reluctant. Farewell, my faithful brother in Christ Jesus. Farewell. Your friend, John Brown." John Brown was executed 3 days later, December 2, 1859. In our next and final chapter in this saga, we will deal with members of our denomination in the Civil War. Did Covenanters fight in the Civil War? And I'll give you a clue. Yes. So that's what we'll be talking about next week. So we're 5 minutes early, ending up. That compensates for the 5 minutes I went over a couple of weeks ago, right? Any questions or comments? Okay, thank you for your kind attention.